Thanks to Brad Steiger for joining us for the first 2 hours of the program. As I mentioned at the beginning, we're looking at big picture stuff here, broad strokes, and we're changing gears just a little bit, but not entirely. Excuse me. You know, you look at the vast panoply of things that we would describe as paranormal, UFOs, ETs, abductions, Bigfoot, crop circles, all that stuff. There's something else that ties them all together, and that is the fact that there's a class of people that say that all of them are hooey, complete nonsense. Every UFO sighting in the history of the world, every example of ESP, every encounter with a strange creature, all of it complete nonsense. I'm talking about the debunkers, for whom there is nothing off-world or other-world or underworld about it. It is all completely made up or misidentification of prosaic phenomena. And those people are taken to task in a new book written by Bill Burns and Joel Martin. It is a blockbuster, an important book. When we come back, we jump right into it. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Bill Burns is a New York Times bestselling author, a magazine publisher, a New York literary publishing agent. You probably know him best as the guy with the hat on UFO Hunters, a hit TV show that ran for a couple of seasons. Bill, it's great to have you back on the program.
Thanks, George. Good to be back, and glad to hear your voice. Glad you're feeling better.
Thank you, sir. I have to tell you that I love the new book. I think it's an important book, but I think it's mistitled. I mean, The Haunting of 21st Century America makes me think it's about ghosts or poltergeists, which, of course, it touches on that, but it's so much more.
Well, here's the funny part about that, and you're right about the title. The funny part is that when Joel and I did this, and we started this book maybe 10 years ago, and when we started it, well, the big decision was, well, how big should the book be, and you know, how many words. We basically kept on writing. I mean, Joel would research, I'd write, I'd research, and we would swap back and forth the material we were doing. And the manuscript got up to something like 900 pages. And so the publisher said, are you guys crazy? We could never publish a book this size. No, break the book up. So we broke the book up into two books. And then when we began working on this particular part of the manuscript, and believe me, we've actually left off a few hundred pages from where we were. We actually added more. For example, in this volume, there were no UFOs because we were planning, and we still may do this, putting all that in the next book. So it wound up being a four book set, but the publisher said, you got to keep the same title. And so that's how the book, the three books in this series, The Haunting, Haunting of the 20th, and Haunting of the 21st, have, that's why they all have the same title.
Well, it's about a lot more than hauntings, and we'll get into that specifically. And while it doesn't get into UFOs, I think the lessons that are in this are very much applicable to the whole UFO field because, as I mentioned in the introduction, you take on the debunkers, and in fact, you slam them to the mat and pummel them relentlessly. Let's start this way. You describe in the beginning about sort of, and I'm using in parentheses, a new age movement. I mean, it is a movement when you look at the vast number of different topics that are sort of lumped together in what you consider.
Yes, it is a movement. And it's funny because it's a movement. You see this pendulum swing. Right. And so in the late 19th century, actually during the time of Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War, there was a movement called the Great Age of Spiritualism. And that began so many things. I mean, actually, the underpinnings of National Socialism began with Helena Blavatsky and, you know, the rise of the Aryan race back in the late 19th century that carried right through to the 20th century and the founding of the Nazi Party and Himmler and going around the world looking for artifacts. So that actually started back in the late 19th century. Lincoln used a medium, a trance medium, after Willie Lincoln died in the White House. You didn't see that in the movie Lincoln, right? And Franklin Pierce used a medium, Grant. We have so much psychic power from our 19th century presidents that even in his 1947 diary, very famous Harry Truman, who was the first president to disclose the existence of UFOs on radio, Harry Truman wrote that he could hear the steps of Lincoln walking up and down on the second floor of the family quarters of the White House, and he's actually seen the ghost of Franklin Pierce. And this is Harry Truman.
I don't want to jump too far ahead, but at the end of this book, you talk about two more recent occupants of the White House, one being the Clinton family, the other being the Reagan family. And, you know, both of those, which are icons on the right and the left, had their own psychic interests, interests in UFOs and other topics of this sort.
Absolutely. I mean, in the case of Ronald Reagan, after the after he was shot, this woman calls Nancy Reagan and basically says, I could have predicted and then helped Ronald Reagan avoid that shot because I can do his chart and give you all of his good days and bad days and dangerous days and things like that. So this was Joan Quigley, who was a psychic, and Nancy Reagan got back to her. They had a chat, and what she wound up doing was plotting Ronald Reagan's chart for every single day he was in office, so that she would say, well, the most propitious time would be 2:31 a.m. to fly to Reykjavik, for example. And this precision of these odd times, even going down to the seconds, was so pervasive that finally Vice President George H.W. Bush saunters into Mike Deaver's office. Mike Deaver was chief of staff. He saunters into his office and basically says, what's with the schedule? Why is the schedule so odd? And when Mike Deaver tells George, you don't know, but Ronald Reagan is using a psychic to predict things, George Bush leans back and says, oh, my God, and walks out of the office. So the Reagans basically had a soothsayer, Pharaoh soothsayer. And in the case of Hillary Clinton, and this is, I just love this story, because, you know, you're watching it, and this is the example of the book. You're watching this happen on television, right? You are a witness to this. This is all over the news, but what's not in the news until afterwards is HRC's reliance on a soothsayer. In this case, it was Gene Houston, who folks can find on Facebook, a soothsayer to help her out. She tells the story on the news of what she calls vast right-wing conspiracy, which is after her husband, right, after the Clinton administration. You could see it rising up. Well, the other president who had, same thing, opposition on the right, a vast right-wing conspiracy, if you want to call it that, was FDR. And FDR had huge, huge enemies in the right wing. And Eleanor Roosevelt, who was actually kind of like a socialist. I mean, she was a wonderful person. She was behind the start of the United Nations. Eleanor Roosevelt counseled him through this entire period of 4 terms in office, actually 3.5 terms in office, less than a half. He died in 1945. And so Eleanor Roosevelt was an icon for women growing up in the 1950s, just an icon. And that's why when Hillary Clinton needed help to help Bill Clinton through some of the toughest times, he was an impeached president. When she did that, she asked Gene Houston to come to the White House. And through trance sessions, she would try to channel the spirit of Eleanor Roosevelt to act the way Eleanor Roosevelt would have acted in these kinds of situations, and mainly for advice in dealing with the onslaught they were facing. Now, can you imagine if she runs for president in 2016, you actually would have a presidential candidate from a major party who had a real personal, firsthand spiritual experience? What would that mean? This would be a first.
Well, we also know that both the Reagans and the Clintons had an ongoing interest in UFOs as well.
Oh,
Reagan having his own experiences, and the Clintons surrounding themselves with people who were interested in the topic.
Right. And Ronald Reagan had actually two experiences with UFOs. The second one is a story that Lucille Ball tells, the comedian Lucille Ball. Ronald and Nancy Reagan, the Reagans were driving down Pacific Coast Highway, which is a route right along the ocean in California. And they're driving down and they see a large UFO over the highway, over PCH, and this is when they're reaching Malibu, and they see this UFO, and it actually slides over the highway, goes out into the Pacific and disappears. Well, Ronald Reagan is so enthusiastic about this that when they, and this party was a party for William Holden, the famous William Holden from the movie Network, etc. So this is a party for William Holden. So when they get to the party, Ronald Reagan tells all the assembled guests about the UFO sighting he had. Well, that so impressed Lucille Ball, and Lucy was a friend of the Reagans, that so impressed Lucille Ball that she wrote about it in her diary. And so that's how folks know that Ronald Reagan had not one, but two UFO sightings. The first one, of course, was when he was governor flying over, flying to Sacramento. He saw a UFO, and he told his pilot to chase it out over the desert. And far from keeping it, and then the UFO disappeared, far from keeping it secret, when Reagan landed in Sacramento, the first person he told about the story was the Sacramento bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, and that's how the story became public.
Let's jump into sort of the heart of your book, the subject of skepticism and debunkers. And there is a difference. And we've talked about the importance of skepticism on this program. You have to be skeptical. You know that as well as anyone, Bill, and in chasing these kinds of esoteric topics, is that you have to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff, the credible from the incredible. However, there's a difference between skepticism and debunking. And you make the point in your book, the debunkers, whether through their own rigid system of disbelief or whether they're paid by some entity like agencies of the government, tend to start from their belief first and then force the facts to fit their belief. In other words, they sort of operate that it can't be and therefore it isn't, and it doesn't matter what evidence exists, we're not going to believe it.
That's exactly right. One of the things that Stan Friedman has always said is that the watchword of debunkers is ABA, anything but aliens. So if you eliminate one whole aspect of your research or of your investigation at the outset, you're forced to go with the strangest explanations that in some cases simply aren't even plausible. I mean, right now I'm writing the second UFO Hunters book, and I'm in the James McDonald chapter, and the Lost Files of James McDonald are just a fascinating place to be because of all the stories, and Stan sent me his congressional testimony, so I'm sitting awash in McDonald material. What they did to him, how they hounded this man, how a bunch of things came together that resulted in his suicide, but nevertheless, even after he's dead, the debunkers pile on, and the stuff they bring up, actually, a flying saucer explanation is more rational than the explanations that debunkers can make, and they're usually wrong. And that's what we found out with some of this stuff. I mean, and we actually proved some of the stuff was wrong. We did it on the show. We do it in books. And that applies really to the whole realm of the paranormal when you think about the controversy between Uri Geller and James Randi.
We'll get into that in a moment. Before we do that, another general question, though, about the debunkers, this group, PsyCop and some of the other notables. Why go to the trouble that they do to jump through hoops and do all kinds of histrionics to come up with explanations that are far less plausible than something paranormal or off-world or something, and being so insistent that there cannot possibly be another explanation?
Well, we were both acquaintances of, because I don't know how many friends he actually had, but we were both acquaintances of Phil Klass. And Phil Klass, yes, the arch debunker of UFOs. Now, Phil Klass was working for Aviation Week, but he was also working for the CIA. And one of his jobs was that he would, as the quote-unquote aeronautics expert, he would debunk, he would find rational explanations for every possible UFO encounter, and he would go beyond it. And this is where kind of a person who had a one mindset was into the world of conspiracy. He would actually try to disparage. He would give warnings. He would act like this FBI investigator investigating a crime into anyone who was who had talked about UFOs. And my personal experience was, of course, as you know, during the Phil Corso book, when Phil Klass was all over it and all over the various people. In fact, he was so negative that when Bill Scott, again, another mutual friend, was writing about the space plane, right, Deep Blue, the space plane back in the late 1980s and early 1990s, when Bill Scott was writing about it, he said he was getting phone calls from Phil Klass saying, look, you shouldn't talk about this. You know, cut it out. Don't do it. I'm telling you right now. And Phil Klass called a movie producer who'd optioned Phil Corso's theatrical rights. He called him and was threatening him, saying, you want to succeed in this industry? Well, you know, you're really on the wrong path, buddy. Things like that. So, but we know he was working for the CIA. And the CIA had really had an angle. It was in their interest, they believed, to keep all these UFO stories under the table and to disparage people who went too far in talking about them. And when it came to scientists, find ways to terminate them with prejudice, so to speak, and shut them up because their credibility was so high. And we actually saw this work out in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. So maybe now less so, but UFO hunters had our own contact with one of these quote-unquote silencers during the third season, who actually turned out to be a really friendly guy and was more revealing of what was going on than trying to silence us. But he did tell me straight to my face, we're sitting having coffee in the morning, and he told me straight to my face, you know, I hope you enjoy this because this is your last season. And I said, what? This is only the second episode, third episode. He said, dude, and he was an older guy. He said, dude, it's over. Okay, so I hope you guys enjoyed the experience, because this is it. You will soon get your notice, but this is over. So, I mean, we had our own experience with that. They work for agencies, and later in the show, I can tell you this unbelievable story of Malachi Martin, who was working for an agency. Partly there were CIA people on the board, but this incredible story of Malachi Martin and the discovery of an artifact from an ancient civilization in the Sphinx. And okay, that's what this guy in black told me, that story.
We'll come back to that. I'll tell you briefly my one experience with Phil Klass. And I would say in the last years of his life, I enjoyed the give and take that we had. It was became a friendlier, more open exchange, letters and once in a while. But in the beginning, I did this show in the 80s. My first UFO interview was with a guy named John Lear. And it was seen at early morning television in Las Vegas by maybe a couple thousand people. Suddenly, Phil Klass comes out of nowhere. I didn't know who he was. And he says, hey, I'm coming to town. I want to do your show. And popped up and did his whole routine. There was no other reason for him to be in town. It wasn't like there was an aviation convention. It was like he'd been dispatched to put out a fire or something. He suddenly, after I did the UFOs, the best evidence, Bob Lazar, that whole stuff, he tried to get me in all kinds of trouble.
He must have gone off the wall. First of all, But look at what you pointed out. The whole thing about John Lear is John Lear's credibility. I love John Lear. Sure. We were at his house twice, for two seasons. And his credibility, when you realize that his level of expertise as a pilot, his experience, his work for the CIA. So for John Lear to come forward, and of course you were part of that history because John Lear, Bob Lazar, Gene Hove out in the desert, for that, that was serious stuff. And his job was not the people that were on the fringe, because they were already laughed at. It's the people who were, like you, who were credible. Lear was credible. You were credible. Bob Lazar was credible. In fact, there's a great story about Lazar now and his uranium sales.
Right.
But, right. But anyway, you guys were credible. His job was to silence you, just like Phil Corso, because of his Army background, work in intelligence, had a level of credibility.
All right. Silence him. Bill Burns, we got to take a break. When we come back, I want to jump into Uri Geller. That story is a perfect capsulization of how this battle has gone. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Bill Burns, co-author with Joel Martin of the new book, The Haunting of 21st Century America, but it's about so much more than hauntings. It's about how some scientists have treated paranormal topics with dismay and disgust, unfairly, in other words. And a perfect example of that is the famed psychic Uri Geller, who was our guest a couple of months ago on this program. This chapter sort of encapsulates the kinds of tactics that have been used, and we jump right into it when we come back here on Coast to Coast AM. Bill Burns, you mentioned earlier some of the tactics that were employed against a famed early UFO researcher, things that basically drove him to commit suicide. The same kind of stuff was focused on Uri Geller, the famed psychic. We had him on the program a couple of months ago. In preparation for that, I read everything I could find about Uri Geller. I watched the documentaries about him. I saw some of the skeptical stuff that had been written about him, and then found him to be a very engaging and interesting guy who was credible to me. And he was credible because some of the scientists who'd done the work with him early on at Stanford Research Institute and elsewhere are the ones who said he was credible, that they are the ones who tested him, and they found that he had abilities that they could not explain. It's the people who were further away from Uri Geller and his abilities who were the harshest critics. And you really do a number on these guys and expose what they did to him. Tell us the story.
Well, when Uri Geller first appeared on the scene, I mean, there are a lot of aspects to the Uri Geller story, and he's a friend. He's a very sweet guy. In fact, one of the things Uri was doing was during a recent war in the Middle East, he was texting kind of his comments from the field because he'd gone up to help injured people. So, I mean, he really is a sweet guy, and he was great on your show. And when he first made his appearance, it was decades ago. He was a very young guy. And the thing that always, there were two things that always struck me about the Uri Geller story and why his appearance was so menacing, was so threatening to the powers that be. I mean, that was the one thing. You have people claiming all kinds of powers. They come, they go, and you don't see any reaction from the debunkers. It's like, who cares? Uri Geller's appearance sparked this unbelievable response, especially from James Randi. And a lot of the skeptics, a lot of the debunkers, not even skeptics, but debunkers were all over this guy. And one of the problems is this, that Uri Geller also had an intellectual relationship. He was a test subject for Puharik, this very famous guy, Andrei Puharik, who, as it turns out, worked for the CIA. And Puharik claimed to be in contact, and Joel Martin was a friend of his, claimed to be in contact with this group called the Nine, these extraterrestrials, and they had direct relationships with counterparts on planet Earth. And according to Puharik, he was working with Uri on making contact with the Nine. Well, that kind of stuff really gets debunkers crazy. I mean, it's like red meat for debunkers. They just slather and go crazy. And so this one person who was kind of dispatched to go after Geller was James Randi. James Randi, and we couldn't put it in the book, there were all kinds of litigation issues about that, so we just didn't even put it in the book. But Joel Martin got personally involved in this because his friend was a guy called, this is a great story, his guy was a friend called Ben Webster. Ben Webster was the guy who invented Velcro. And Ben Webster, I say, he was obviously an entrepreneurial guy, a scientist. And Ben Webster was a friend of Uri Geller's, and Joel Martin was in the mix with this private detective and other attorneys who were doing opposition research on James Randi because they knew there'd be a big lawsuit between Geller and Randi. And as it turned out, they came up with some incredible stuff that I can't go into in detail, but it led me to believe that there are individuals who do work for the government that you'd never know it was the government behind them, that basically you see at what point they had to be turned to work for the government. And that's what we found when we saw some of this material. So James Randi and the other person who got involved was the comedian Johnny Carson. He was investing in a corporation that was a kind of debunker corporation. Ostensibly, it was a scientific corporation. And the link that Randi and Johnny Carson had, of course, were they were both magicians. And for a magician, for a professional magician, that's like a difference between, well, no, it isn't. A professional magician is going to debunk the paranormal. He's going to say it's all a trick and it's all illusion, because a professional magician's credibility as a performer and as an illusionist fades away if people think, oh, well, because he has a power, he can do that. So it's a weird thing. And Uri Geller came into that mix because James Randi was attacking him, and debunkers from people like PSYOPs and various groups, yeah, PSYCOPs, were attacking this guy. And every time they tried to duplicate one of his experiments, stopping watches, starting watches, every time they tried to do that, they failed because they had to change one of the aspects of what Geller was doing. And of course, they couldn't bend it. And Geller was doing that. And Geller's techniques and his abilities to manifest his energy and focus his energy were so apparent that one of the people who became a big fan of what Uri Geller was doing and was able to demonstrate this himself was, of course, the very famous General Stubblebine, who was the head of the remote viewing unit for the Army in Maryland. So, and the connection was very tight, because you mentioned Stanford Research Institute, which was really the home of the very first coordinate remote viewing experiments after Ingo Swann demonstrated his extraordinary powers. So, as John Alexander told me and told me publicly, the U.S. government absolutely believes in, invests in, has no doubt about the existence of the paranormal, all the way from the NSA through the CIA through the United States military. But it's important to use that in their view. It's important to use that without trumpeting the fact that the paranormal is real. Can you imagine a president getting up and saying, oh, well, we know the paranormal is real because, and start listing all the things, you know, we know that people have a sixth sense, we know that psychokinesis is real, we know that prognostication is real. Oh, yeah, it's all real. Suddenly, a lot of those kinds of stories that through the years, I go into that too, have been relegated to demons and Satan and things like that, suddenly you'd find yourself in a hotbed of all kinds of conflict
Back to Uri Geller for a second. There's Geller, who is telegenic and young and charismatic. He's unabashed about his interest in stardom. He's got a high profile. He's making money and making converts, seemingly doing these amazing feats with ease. I can see that he'd be a major threat to them. You know, the people who at Stanford Research and then a half dozen other labs, the people who were closest to him, who were there under lab conditions and did the tests, all came to the same conclusion. This guy's for real. It's the debunkers who were nowhere near these tests who said, oh, that's not true, we can duplicate it, and then never did.
No, they never did. Even James Randi wasn't able to duplicate what Uri Geller could do when he was on Johnny Carson. So Uri Geller was a real threat. And he basically knows a lot more about how the United States government is invested in the paranormal than he talks about.
And it's not just the U.S. government. He's come out and just pretty much said it, that he worked for other governments as well, or he's confirmed that other people have said it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the United States was in kind of a psychic war with the Soviet Union during the 1970s and 80s, as both sides tried to weaponize the paranormal. We did, they did, and Uri Geller knows that history very well. He talks about that history. But it was really important to keep that psychic war under wraps. And Uri Geller was a victim of debunkers who basically, you're right, they could never duplicate the things he could do. They never had tests with the same kind of parameters that he had. They could never do it. And yet they were the ones that debunked him and said it was simply an illusion.
You make a great point in the book about some members of PSYCOP, this ultimate skeptics organization, who found that the organization was dishonest. They quit in disgust because data was misreported or misrepresented.
Well, that's right. And that goes all the way back to the days of Harry Houdini, who, after his conflict with Arthur Conan Doyle, began to Lady Doyle had said to Houdini after his mother died, his mother's name was Coy Weiss, after his mother died, oh, well, you know, she's asleep in the arms of Jesus or something. And Harry Houdini went off the wall. In anger, that was the end of his relationship with Arthur Conan Doyle, and he began to hoax hoax tests to prove that the paranormal was a lie. And he was hoaxing stuff. And that idea of hoaxing a test to prove the paranormal is a lie just extends right through the whole time of Uri Geller, when people from PsyCops discovered that attempts to disprove the paranormal in experiments, those attempts were hoaxed. And it went right through the Rex Heflin photographs of the 1960s, right through ufology, and it is running today. I mean, you can actually see it before your very eyes.
How would you describe the state of skepticism today, or rather the state of the debunkers? Are they still as strong as they were when, say, Phil Klass was around, or are they on the run?
I don't think they're on the run. And I think that, and you'll see these guys on television all the time. They will be the ones who, if there's ever a story of something paranormal popping up, these guys will be on the show to basically downplay it, to say that it's not real. And to show you how they've really advanced, you see this happening now just among regular politicians. They will debunk stories, and they, which are true, and the debunking is more implausible than the stories they're actually debunking. And I see this, I mean, I see this all the time. And now people are using debunker stories to for political purposes. So no, they haven't faded away. They're not on the run. In fact, they have leaked over into other areas of discourse right now.
It seems, though, in some ways they've lost the fight. The public has moved on. You look at your program, this program, all the shows on television about ghosts and Bigfoot and interest in paranormal and UFOs. I mean, it seems like the public has decided.
Well, the public has decided. You're perfectly right about that. And science has also decided in large measure that some of the things that we always talked about as paranormal are actually real. And with more scientific discoveries in some of them, in the whole range of, for example, dark matter, dark energy, in the whole range of that, you can imagine that those stories that are science are actually stranger than fiction. Quantum entanglement, those kinds of things. When that hits the public, sure, the major news organizations try and dilute them as much as possible. We don't want to make too much hype or even laugh at some of them. But a lot of that, a lot of those new discoveries are really confronting debunkers with the fact that science is merging the normal and the paranormal.
How much of what we would describe as overt hostility to, quote, the paranormal, UFOs, ETs, all that stuff, how much of it coming from the debunkers is really about religion, about their disdain for religion or anything even close to religion?
Well, it's funny that you mention that, because on the one hand, you see a lot, and you see it on television all the time, you see a lot of this kind of these are agnostics or atheists who basically say that anything talking about another world beyond our five senses is false, is insane, is delusional. Add your own term. So that's a major part of it. The other major part of it comes from the very devout religious groups who say talking about the paranormal is really talking about demonology. So you have both sides of the spectrum, both corners of the spectrum, basically converging on what I'd call mainstream paranormal stories. I mean, more than half of the people in America believe that flying saucers are real. They can't tell you where they come from. They don't know how they get here, but they believe that there is another form of presence. A huge majority of Americans claim they either have had themselves or know someone who's had an experience with a ghostly figure. They don't know where the ghost came from, where the ghost lives, where the ghost resides. They don't know that. All they know is somebody claims to have. I mean, I had one. Joe Martin had one. You have these strange encounters that you can rationalize but stay with you because you know deep inside these things are real and they're not a hallucination.
Yeah, that's what I meant about maybe they've lost the battle and they just don't know it. Let's shift gears to another chapter. We've got about 5 minutes and then we'll have to take a break when you hear the music. But the story about Candy Jones, Long John Nebel, and MK Ultra really grabbed my attention and is a tearjerker.
It is, and the story of MK Ultra, I mean, it's too long for one night, but it goes way, way back. It has its roots in World War II, actually. And in the case of Candy Jones, she was the perfect subject for an experiment. And by the way, I mean, I'll just say this, and then we could pick it up again. It was projects related to MK Ultra that I think, and I've got a book coming out next year talking about it, that I think influenced the whole Sandy Hook tragedy because of how each person, each of these mass murderers, follow a previous one, read their stories. And in this case, Adam Lanza read Anders Breivik, the Norwegian guy, and Anders Breivik's manifesto is based on Ted Kaczynski's manifesto. And when Ted Kaczynski was a young teenager, well, was a teenager at Harvard in his freshman year, he wound up in a course that was taught by someone who had worked in World War II for intelligence agencies testing resiliency. And Ted Kaczynski was in that course being tested. And that really, for a teenager, that demoralized him in a way that I believe really set him up. And a lot of that manifesto that he wrote echoes his experiences with his experience at Harvard. And when you realize that kind of stuff is toxic, that permeates across generations. And of course, then you find out that Adam Lanza is reading that manifesto. Unbelievable. Well, the point that I'm trying to get to is that that was the result of MK Ultra testing in the 1950s. And of course, we have two modern things. We have the games people play, and I'm Okay, You're Okay, that came directly out of what the CIA was doing with medical doctors in Canada in the 1950s. And yeah, so the story of Candy Jones, and she's only one of many whom the CIA tried to use and just have a whole kind of subconscious network of agents carrying stuff back and forth, carrying messages, then forgetting them, and then destroying themselves at the end of it. And the impact on Long John Nebel was unbelievable, and he talked about it a lot.
Well, Candy Jones is this beautiful model who ends up, she has an interesting life. She ends up married to this late-night radio host, Long John Nebel, who was sort of the George Norrie, Art Bell of his day. And he, over time, discovers that something's really wrong with his wife, that somebody's been messing with her mind.
That's right. And what happens in the middle of, because he knew nothing about this. In fact, talk about skeptics. Long John Nebel was a total skeptic, didn't believe anything that was on his show. And Candy Jones, in the middle of the night, would wake up screaming. And he couldn't. And when he would talk to her, she would have a different voice, so that it wasn't her voice. And he couldn't figure out how she had that strange voice. One night, she actually tried to kill him with a knife. And so what he began doing, she talked to his friends, and they said, why don't you try using regressive hypnosis to see what's dealing with that personality? And so she went through a number of sessions, and through the sessions, Long John was able to elicit from her the fact that when she ran her modeling agency in New York in the late 1940s after the war, she was contacted by an old friend of hers who said he worked for the government and wondered, and she had a failing modeling agency, and suggested that if she needed to make some extra money, she could work for him because he was working for the government. And she agreed. What she never agreed to was the kinds of drugs she took, the hypnosis sessions that she had to undergo, and the fact that what they developed in Candy Jones was another personality.
Bill, we have to take a break at that point, and you can pick up that fascinating story on the other side. Much more to come here with Bill Burns on Coast to Coast AM.